Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco at the club's new building at 110 The Embarcadero. And I'd also like to welcome our radio audiences and our online audiences. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce Rob Reich, professor at Stanford, author of Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better. As soon as I got the email about this one, I said, yes, that's very good. I like this because I have my own experiences that back up that question. How philanthropy is not 100% positive at all times, as everybody here must have figured out. So, Rob, thanks a lot for coming to talk to us about your book.
Well, thanks to everyone for coming out on a somewhat rainy night. And I got some friends and family in the audience as well. It's my first time ever giving a talk at a place like the Commonwealth Club, so it's exciting for me. I got some support in the room. But for those of you who aren't family and friends, I want to get something out of the way right at the top, which is that my name is Rob Reich, but of course I am not the Robert Reich. I share a name with the guy who teaches across the bay at Berkeley, and I know that he's a common stay here at the Commonwealth Club and has graced the stage many, many times. He did give a blurb to the back of my book, which is amusing, however, so you can see that on the outside if you want. All right, so I'm going to talk no more than 30 minutes, and I really want to have a discussion with you about this idea that, as George put it, philanthropy is not the unassailable good thing, not the automatic good thing that we often think it to be. And I'm a philosopher by training, and philosophers' vocation, possibly their social value, is that they ask inconvenient questions. They try to challenge conventional wisdom, and indeed, that's in many respects the impulse behind this book. The book attempts to lay out for the reader what I describe as the ethical and political dimensions of philanthropy, and how the way that we often treat a philanthropic act, or the way perhaps you think of yourself as a donor, whether you're a big donor or a small donor, with good intentions, the good intentions always might appear to excuse whether or not the money was well used. At least you tried. And I want to try to make that a more complicated story. In short, if I had to reduce the message of the book to a kind of simple one sentence, it would be the following, that we need, as a scholar and as an ordinary citizen, to direct far more attention to the phenomenon of philanthropy, and it deserves our scrutiny, not just our gratitude. And I want to try to explain why I think that's so. One prefatory note before getting into the meat of the talk. One natural tendency I've experienced when I talk about philanthropy is that people who listen and then want to engage in the topic are tempted to think that what I want to get to is something that would be advice to them as a donor. I have come in with some ideas about how you can do philanthropy better. And there is, in fact, a minor industry of scholars and philanthropic advisors whose task that is to advise people to do philanthropy. But I'm really not in the business of trying to assess any individual donor's preferences, choices, how much money they give away, where they give it away. I'm not here to say that the way Tom Steyer does it is better than the Koch brothers. I'm a political philosopher, which means I want to train our attention on the policies and the social norms that help give shape to and structure all of charitable giving. So I'm going to begin with a couple stories that will help you, I think, unearth intuitions that I believe you already possess about why philanthropy is much more complicated than the simple story about it often leads us to think it is. So the first story is about ordinary charitable giving, and the second story is about big philanthropy, the activity of people who typically have foundations. All right. The first story, I can put it in a first-person voice. It's something that likely some of you in the room have had experience with. I've lived here in the Bay Area for about 25 years, and maybe 15 years ago, had some kids for the first time. The oldest of them was getting ready to go off to the school district in down the peninsula where I live. And on the first day of public school kindergarten, my son came home with the usual array of materials from the school. And it included a statement from the district that welcomed us and expressed such pleasure that we had chosen the school district to send our child. And in big letters at the bottom, that our expected but voluntary contribution to the school district was $2,000 per child. You may get some of these things yourself. The town behind Stanford is Woodside. Woodside, one of the wealthiest suburbs in the peninsula. They raise more than $4,800 per child in Woodside every single year, almost exceeding the amount of public money that goes to the Woodside school. Here's what happens in Hillsboro. This is the letter that went home in 2013 in Hillsboro. The expected contribution per child is $2,300 a kid. There's a stretch contribution you can make of $10,000 a child. They raise many thousands of dollars in private philanthropy to supplement the public school system. Here is the current website of the Ross School in Ross School District in Marin, I think. They raise $3,500 per kid, $1.3 million a year for a relatively small school. So your intuition is probably along the lines of what mine is. You can see where this is going already, I predict. There's something, of course, understandable, even noble about this, the idea that there is an insufficient public funding base for the public school system, and a recognition, of course, that the cause of that is somewhere else. It's out in Sacramento. It's the school finance system in California. And that rather than opting out into a private school, you can support the public school system by topping up what the public funding is by making a charitable contribution to your own kid's school. Now, as a scholar rather than as a parent, I thought to myself, it would be interesting to try to trace the sum total of these donations as many public schools in California as I could. I undertook this just tiny little research project then, and of course it turns out exactly the way common sense would predict. Wealthy suburbs can raise way more philanthropic money per kid than big cities can or than poor places can. Palo Alto raises way more money per child than East Palo Alto. Any suburban district raises way more money philanthropically per child than Oakland, San Francisco, San Jose. So it occurred to me that here is an example of charity that does not address disadvantage or the poor, but in fact does the opposite. It confers additional advantage on people who are already, relatively speaking, advantaged in the first place. Palo Alto schools getting relatively better than East Palo Alto schools. And it happens under the framework of being a charitable person. Of course, you could point to some self-interested benefits along the way. It's not just that you're helping, to some extent, your own child. It's not accidental that the realtors in any suburb are a huge fan of school foundations because, of course, this props up your property values. What really got to me, though, despite seeing how this was an example of charity that amplified advantage rather than being directed to the poor, was when I realized that you could make these contributions, still can today, with a tax subsidy attached to them. The local school foundations and PTAs and PTOs that collect these contributions are registered 501c3 charities. And so we have a system in the United States where the U.S. government, the federal government, subsidizes charitable contributions, and in this case, to your own kid's public school, so that, quite literally, the rest of the entire country is helping to pay for, in the form of lost tax revenue, the further advantaging of kids in wealthy suburbs. And I thought to myself, well, gee, that seems even worse than the initial thought, which was that we're giving money away, thinking it's charitable to advantage our own children who are already, relatively speaking, advantaged. Now, the rest of the country is subsidizing this activity in a way that seemed very strange. So I thought to myself then, as a scholar, I should go try to find out a bit more about why it is that there are tax incentives for charitable giving in the first place. And the lesson I want to take from this is then when I went looking, you find out some interesting facts about American charity. I'm going to show you now some graphs that show you the total distribution of charitable dollars in the United States. In the U.S., this is from 2 years ago, 2016, there's a total of $390 billion given away. And interesting, the largest category of recipients is religion, which is giving to your church, your synagogue, your mosque. If you're thinking to yourself, oh, but some of that is social services, it's faith-based social services, a Salvation Army or a Mercy Corps, you'd be wrong. It's a nice thought. Those faith-based social service organizations have already been sectioned off into the relevant categories of public society benefit or human services. So the fact that a third of all American charity goes to support religion is just to pay the pastor to keep the lights on and the cost of running the religious organization. And you'll notice here that public society benefit human services are pretty small. Now, There are four sources of giving in the United States. There's gifts from living individuals, bequests from people who have died, foundation giving, and then corporate philanthropy. The vast majority, three-quarters of it, comes from living individuals. So here's a picture of where living individuals, the 75% of charitable giving, where that goes. You notice here that it rockets up in religion. Religion accounts for individual giving for more than 50% of all charitable giving. If I wanted to be cheeky, maybe overly provocative, I would suggest here that giving to your church is akin to paying a membership due in a particular organization that you belong to, not something that's a public benefit for the rest of society. So it seems interesting at the very least to suggest or to see that so much of what happens in American charity is support for religion. Notice basic needs of people, 10% of all of American charity. This is all giving. What happens now if we section off just the giving preferences of the wealthy? We look at what especially wealthy people do charitably. Here's the picture. You notice religion goes way down. Wealthy people are not supporting churches. They're supporting education, healthcare. Look what happened to basic needs, down to 4%. The wealthier you are in the United States, the less likely you are to support the poor in your charity. The more likely you are to give to Stanford University, the Arts Museum, or specialized hospital wing with a special kind of health care. Here's another way of looking at this all together. The left-hand side of the graph is lower income. Right-hand side of the graph is higher income. Religion dominates for the middle class and working class. It diminishes as you get wealthier. Basic needs is always small, 10%, and shrinks to about 4% as you get richer. All right, now I want to address one objection or concern that might be in your head. You might be thinking to yourself, or I hope some people are thinking to themselves now, okay, so giving to Stanford University, giving to the San Francisco, museums, some of that can be assistance for the disadvantaged. You can fund programs for financial aid at Stanford. You can provide access to kids at the museum who might not be able to attend. So there's a study done to try to provide the most maximally generous assumptions about how much money in any category goes to assist the disadvantaged. And here's what that study looks like. For all donors, if you just max out as much as possible how much could go to the disadvantaged in all the different categories, you get to 31%, a third of giving for assistance to the poor, and for the rich, it's 22%. So what I want to convey to you here is that even in the best case scenario, if you are tempted to think that charity has something to do with almsgiving, that philanthropy's purpose has something to do with taking relatively extra or luxury resources of your own and directing them to assist other people in need, the fact of the matter is that is not what's happening in American charity. Now, I want to give one partial explanation about why this is, and that explanation has to do with public policy, not a decision that you or I make about, I just happen to prefer to give to a wealthy institution already like a museum or a university, but rather policy itself. And that is that in order to qualify as an organization, a nonprofit organization that is eligible to give a donor a tax deduction, you have to apply to become a 501c3 public charity with the IRS. And the United States allows the most kaleidoscopic array of organizations to exist as nonprofits. And every single year, it approves between 60 and 70,000 new organizations as 501c public charities. If you fill out your application completely with a little bit of, pro bono legal help, the rate of approval by the IRS is over 99%. So we have almost literally what I think is fair to describe as an anything-goes nonprofit sector. You can erect yourself as a public charity so long as basically you don't engage in nefarious self-dealing and distribute profits to people or pay the executive director wildly excessive salaries. Short of that, you can affix almost any purpose to a nonprofit organization. And if that's the case, people will create organizations and build development offices and do all kinds of other things to solicit charitable donations, and you get a picture of American charity like the one I just showed you. All right. Well, so we have a picture of charity that it's not mainly about almsgiving, and a picture of charity that's not about almsgiving, that's because it's partly because of our public policies. And we also know that charity is tax subsidized. So let me finish my story here about ordinary giving, this giving to your own kids' public school, with a short little anecdote to illustrate the interesting, troubling feature of the tax subsidies that are at work in charitable giving. George Soros, about 20, 30 years ago, was setting up his Open Society Institute and Foundations, his charitable enterprises based in the East Coast. And like most people do when they have a lot of money and they want to establish a foundation, they hire some program staff, and there's an internal deliberation about what program areas that the foundation will be devoted to. So they were in the tail end of that process before going public with what they were going to be and do. And an investigative journalist named Mark Dowie was visiting the planning of the Soros philanthropic entities, and he reported that at the end of one of these meetings, there was disagreement amongst the hired program staff and Soros himself about what the final decision should be about the program areas. And so Soros, kind of with an irritated voice, pounded his fist on the table and said, well, you know, goddammit, at the end of the day, it's my money, so we're going to do it my way. And a junior program officer said at that point, well, Mr. Soros, actually, 40% of the money in this endowment would be in the U.S. Treasury if you hadn't put it here in the first place. So I think some other people should have a say, too. He was fired the next week, but he had a good point. When we tax subsidize charitable giving, it gives every single one of us an interest in what happens with charity because we are all collectively, in a certain respect, paying for the philanthropic and charitable choices of other people. The U.S. Treasury lost about $50 billion last year in foregone tax revenue to pay for the subsidies that attach mainly to wealthy people. I'm going to come back and talk about that in a minute. Here's my second story. This is the way the book begins. It's a photo of John D. Rockefeller. And the story I want to tell you about is about what happened with Rockefeller when he was the Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos of his day. He had amassed through Standard Oil the largest fortune that America had ever seen, and he was ready to start returning some of his enormous fortune to society by becoming a philanthropist. And this was his main advisor, a guy named Frederick Gates. Gates told him that his fortune was so large that he couldn't just do small ball charitable giving. He had to try something on a much grander scale in order to do this systematically. And the idea was born in their heads to create a general purpose foundation with a local, national, and global scope of activity. So you probably know that today when you hear what the Rockefeller Foundation is devoted to, it's something like stewarding and improving the condition of humankind, which is a mission under which you can do almost anything. So Rockefeller decided, along with Gates, that he needed to have a special imprimatur, a special permission for this novel thing of a massively endowed foundation with this global scope. And so rather than trying to seek to create the foundation where he lived in New York State, they went off to the U.S. Congress to ask for Congress to pass a bill to incorporate the Rockefeller Foundation, because the laws in New York State didn't allow a philanthropic entity with a global scope. You were meant to support the people in New York mainly. So off they go to Washington, D.C., and what happens? Well, this is Teddy Roosevelt. He was just out of office when Rockefeller and his advisors went down to Congress. Roosevelt complained of Rockefeller's idea by saying that no amount of charity in spending such a fortune can compensate in any way for the misconduct in first acquiring it. This is Samuel Gompers on the right. He was the head of the American Federation of Labor. Of course, Rockefeller had been involved in various union busting activities, so Gompers wasn't entirely thrilled with what Rockefeller had done. Samuel Gompers testified before Congress saying the following: the one thing that the world would gratefully accept from Mr. Rockefeller now would be the establishment of a great endowment of research and education to help other people see, in time, how they can keep from becoming like him. This is G.K. Chesterton, one of the most powerful stylists, prose stylists of the day. Chesterton, this is a little bit longer, but it's so juicy, I'm just going to read this to you. Chesterton weighed in from New Zealand about the idea of the Rockefeller Foundation. This is what he said of Rockefeller. Philanthropy, as far as I can see, is rapidly becoming the recognizable mark of a wicked man. We have often sneered at the superstition and the cowardice of the medieval barons who thought that giving lands to the church could wipe out the memory of their raids and robberies. But modern capitalists seem to have exactly the same notion, with this addition, that in the case of the capitalists, the memory of the robbery is really wiped out. This, after all, seems to be the chief difference between the monks who took land and gave pardons and the charity organizers who take money and give praise. The difference is that the monks wrote down in their books and chronicles, quote, received 300 acres from a really bad person, whereas the modern experts who work in nonprofit organizations record the 300 acres and call him a generous donor. If you have read the new book by Anand Giridharadas called Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, Chesterton was on to the thesis more than 100 years ago, that, as Anand Giridharadas puts it, the harms done by capitalist daylight can't be excused by the modest philanthropic acts done by moonlight. Now, that's already one reason to be skeptical of the acts of great philanthropists. But I'm more interested in some other notions, notions that don't focus our attention on the ill deeds of the money-making in the first place. I'm more interested in, as it were, assuming that there is a legitimate wealth entitlement or creation, and we're just focusing on whether it's a good thing now to have something called a big private foundation. So the guy on the screen right now is John Haynes Holmes. He was a well-known Unitarian minister. He was the founding board chair of the American Civil Liberties Union. He testified before Congress saying the following: I take it for granted that the men who are directing these foundations, the men who represent the Rockefeller Foundation, are men of wisdom, men of insight, men of vision. They have the best motives. But my standpoint here is the whole thought of democracy. And from this standpoint, it seems to me that the Rockefeller Foundation and its very character are repugnant to the whole idea of a democratic society. This is Louis Brandeis. He would, of course, later go on to be a Supreme Court justice. He was one of the early trust busters as a lawyer. He testified before Congress that foundations were inconsistent with democracy, and he had grave apprehensions about assigning even greater power to already very wealthy men. All right, what's going on in the heads of these people that we never hear anything like this today? This is not about their marketplace activities. It's about the idea of a foundation itself. And here, all I want to submit to you is the idea of taking seriously, in a descriptive sense, what it is that a large foundation represents. A large foundation represents an exercise of power by a wealthy person, virtually by definition. It's an attempt to take your private assets and direct them for some public influence, often these days, with a naked ambition to change public policy. It's an exercise of power that is basically unaccountable because in a foundation, there's no marketplace competition. The Gates Foundation can't put out of business the Ford Foundation. To the contrary, what they have are an absence of competition and no consumers who can decide to stop buying what's on offer. All you have are supplicant nonprofit organizations looking for a next grant or a grant in the first place. So you have no marketplace competition amongst the foundations, no accountability there, and of course no one stands for election. Diane Ravitch, for those of you who follow the Gates Foundation's education policies, has called Bill Gates the nation's unelected school superintendent. If you don't agree with Bill Gates' preferred education policies, what is it that you can do? You could write a letter to the newspaper saying Bill Gates should change his ideas. But there's no foundation that is competing with Gates. There's no place to put Gates out of office. The board of trustees of the Gates Foundation is Bill Gates, Melinda Gates, Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates Sr. And in fact, the trustees of almost all private foundations are the immediate family members of the people who created it. So, low accountability, very low transparency. Here's something that shocked me when I discovered it. There are about 100,000 private foundations in the United States today. 90% of them don't have a website. So that if you were a nonprofit organization and wanted to try to receive a grant, you wouldn't even know necessarily that the foundation existed. It's really only the very largest foundations that have professional staffs and have a website and a system for recruiting or soliciting grant applications. But the overwhelming majority of foundations are kind of black boxes that allow the hand-picked members who founded it and run it complete freedom to do whatever it is they wish, under cover of darkness, so to speak. Another strange policy arrangement. There is an insistence in law that the wishes of the donor are the only thing that matter legally. That's the thing with there's no community governance about what goes on in the foundation. What the donor wants is what the charitable purpose is. And what's more, it's a donor direction that's guaranteed by default in perpetuity, so that the dead hand of the donor reaches out of the grave to strangle the preferences of you and I, the living. And finally, just like ordinary charity, what foundations are lavishly tax-advantaged as well. So what the private foundation represents, what Rockefeller created, is an exercise of power by the wealthy that's mostly unaccountable, mostly non-transparent, donor-directed, by default perpetual, and generously tax-advantaged. It's a plutocratic voice in a democratic society where you have an expectation of political equality. And my question is, what was the good part about the whole idea in the first place? Today, rather than giving Rockefeller the skepticism and scrutiny that he received, we instead lavish praise and celebration on our great philanthropists. We put them on the cover of Time as the people of the year. We champion them and put their names on buildings and hospitals. And we lavish them with attention for their new charitable acts, as the case is with Bezos. What I want to suggest to you is that at a minimum, the appropriate attitude, as I said at the start, toward a philanthropic act is not gratitude, but some scrutiny. How is it, I want to ask in this book, can our public policies and social norms orient the activity of philanthropy to support democratic aspirations rather than potentially to undermine them? And so I'm going to end this talk having foregrounded an awful lot of skepticism, trying to drum out of you, as it were, some intuitions that hopefully you share now with me about why charity and philanthropy might seem problematic. But I want to close with some modest redemption, both for ordinary charity and for big philanthropy, and then I'll open it up to questions. So remember I said I want to focus attention on public policies and social norms, not on the individual decisions of donors. So let's begin with the mechanism that currently exists, the tax incentive that treats ordinary giving that you or I make, including the giving of wealthy people. So a tax deduction has itself baked into it a plutocratic bias. It amplifies the voices of the already wealthy in a way that just seems to me completely indefensible. So if we're going to have tax incentives for giving, we should do it very differently than we do now. So what this shows you is that depending on how much money you make, what tax bracket you're in, your incentive or subsidy rate is different. So let's say Doug is at the top of an income bracket and I am in the bottom of an income bracket. Doug makes a $1,000 contribution to the local soup kitchen. And let's say that I make the identical $1,000 contribution to the identical soup kitchen. He and I have both created the identical social benefit because the organization received the same amount of money from each of us. If Doug is at the top tax bracket, he would be taxed usually at 40%. So the $1,000 contribution he makes costs him actually $600 because $400 is forgiven from his tax bill, which is to say the rest of us all lose out on $400 of tax revenue that would otherwise go to DC. If I'm in the 28% tax bracket, my $1,000 contribution costs me $720, even though I'm less wealthy than Doug is, and the Treasury loses out on $280. To put it in a way that I don't mean to be a provocation, I mean this to be quite literal, the wealthier you are, the cheaper it is to be virtuous in the United States.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Why would we want policies that systematically subsidize wealthy people for their preferences more than the average person? And yet that's exactly what we have. It's possible to correct this by getting rid of the tax deduction at all and replacing it, for example, with a tax credit. I'll have some other ideas I could share with you later on as well. How about big philanthropy? What can we do about big philanthropy? Well, first of all, we should get rid of the default arrangement of perpetuity, which allows the dead to govern the living. So some large foundations now, in fact, are voluntarily signing on to spend-out clauses. In fact, the Gates Foundation is pledged to spend out all of its endowment within 40 years of the death of Bill and Melinda Gates. And other foundations, especially some started by people who are still living, have committed to the same thing. By contrast, as I said before, the default legal arrangement for any private foundation is that it will exist in perpetuity. Perpetuity is a really long time horizon. But even if we got rid of that, that still leaves the power of the big philanthropist intact. It just shortens the time span on which it can be operated. So how is it possible, I want to ask, that you can take this seeming vice of unaccountability in the hands of a big, powerful donor and possibly convert it into a virtue? So I want to try that kind of circus act for you right now. I want to do so by directing attention first to something that I possess that my guess is many of you in the room think is ludicrous and indefensible. I'm a professor at Stanford, and I have tenure, which means that I have a complete performance unaccountability. I have no performance reviews. I basically have to teach the classes I teach. And otherwise, if I stop publishing, if I stop having office hours, I can't be fired. The whole arrangement of tenure is meant to insulate me from any type of performance metric. Now, of course, I had to earn tenure in the first place. It didn't come through a marketplace act. And that was really hard to do. But now that I have tenure, as I said before, my guess is many of you think, that sounds like a crazy arrangement, a recipe for laziness, a recipe for, you know, a lack of productivity. And if tenure is defensible, here's one story about it. What tenure allows for scholars is for us to be able to take long-time horizon, risk-taking experimental approaches to research. So that if I decide, you know, I think I need to learn two languages and go do some field work in a different place, and then try to synthesize all of this into an article or a book, and that's going to take me 5 or 6 years. And if you ask me 2 years from now what I have to show for myself, I'd say, oh, I've been in the library. Tenure allows me to do that. It allows other people to stick themselves into a lab and seek scientific discoveries. It allows others to solve math proofs or theorems, et cetera, et cetera. It allows scholars to take these long-time horizon bets on their research so that some of them might produce new truths or might produce new knowledge. Here's the real important part. That would almost certainly not happen in the marketplace or in a government agency, which are harnessed to much shorter time horizons. In the marketplace because of investor pressures or competition, and in a public agency because if the elected official said, we're going to spend a whole bunch of money with no guarantee of success, in fact, it's super risky, and it might not even see any results for 20 years, that person has a really low chance of being reelected. So what tenure allows is for this type of activity to happen. Now, if it should turn out, and a few of you in the room are tenured faculty too, if it should turn out that what faculty do with tenure is to make little small ball incremental additions to knowledge, a little review article here and a small little, you know, article here, and you could just get rid of tenure entirely and put us on 5-year renewable contracts for some output, and nothing about the world would change. Get rid of tenure if professors turn out to be conservative, incremental scholars. Okay, what's the lesson here? I hope you see the connection. What tenure is to the scholar's brain, the private foundation is to the endowment in a foundation. It's an institutional arrangement for unaccountable performance. So what is it that foundations could do with those dollars that would help democratic society? If what helps a democratic society is an experimental approach to social problem solving, which sometimes marketplace entities do and sometimes public agencies do, but each of which are harnessed to these shorter time horizons, they can't take 20-year bets on something without likely being punished somehow through this internal logic of marketplace accountability or electoral accountability. What foundations can do is they can pioneer experimental, risky social undertakings to try to attack some social problems. And if and when they have a successful innovation, they can humbly present it to the ultimate scaling mechanism of all, the government. No foundation has enough money to take a successful social innovation and then say, we in the foundation will fund this for every single citizen for all of time. One of the things that Bill Gates likes to say about education is that even if you complain about his policy choices, if you were to liquidate all of the money in the Gates Foundation tomorrow, it would amount to a fraction of the annual public expenditures on schooling in the United States. So foundation people, for them to be successful, ultimately have to leverage government dollars or possibly marketplace investments. Here's the classic example of that, the Carnegie Library System. Andrew Carnegie, when he tried this out more than 100 years ago, did not say to every town across the land that the Carnegie Foundation would like to fund free access to knowledge and books for all of time and for every town. He said, let's try a few out in different places. If citizens like them, if they find value in them, they will ask their public officials to fund them publicly. If it should turn out that what foundations do is to take this experimental long-time horizon approach, not a perpetual approach, but a long-time horizon approach longer than the marketplace, longer than government, democratic government, then I want to suggest to you that plutocrats can successfully be domesticated to serve democratic society rather than to anoint themselves, as they often do today, as people who are trying to work around the inefficient and dysfunctional government, which, of course, it sometimes is. They're not wrong. But unless the philanthropist wants to be on the hook for funding whatever successful thing they do for all people, rather than just a nice little island of excellence, if things go well, they ultimately have to leverage dollars that are elsewhere. They have to humbly present their ideas for an addition of a stamp of democratic approval or an avalanche of capital investment in the marketplace. If they can do that, then perhaps private foundations and big philanthropy can be rendered compatible with and indeed supportive of democracy. All right, I gave you some redemption. I'm going to stop now, and I'd love to hear any questions you have about any of the aspects of the book, and happy to talk about anything on your mind about philanthropy. So thank you.
Two questions. The hand from the grave did not seem to hold on to the Rockefeller Foundation very well. It went off in a direction he would not have approved. And the other one is, what do you think of Trump's raising the tax deduction to 20,000, and will that affect the amount of giving that goes on?
Good. So just out of curiosity, let me take the second question first. Yeah. How many people in the room here have itemized on their taxes and taken a charitable deduction for their giving? All right, so a good number of people have a sense about how this works. So if you only take the standard deduction, you don't itemize, then you effectively get no incentive to give. So if you take the standard deduction, whether you make charitable contributions or not, it doesn't matter. You just get the standard deduction. Because of the new Trump tax law, before the new tax law took effect, only 30% of Americans itemize, which is to say the incentive only works for 30% of people, basically people who own homes and have a high income. Now the prediction is that only 10% of Americans will itemize because the standard deduction has been raised, and there's the cap, of course, on the state and local taxes. So it's an even more perverse form of what I showed before about the upside-down nature of the incentive, because now only 10% of the wealthiest people in the country will have any tax incentive at all, which is to say that the public policy mechanism will be targeted for the giving preferences of the wealthy, which, if you remember the graphs I've shown you, are not a mirror of the giving preferences of all people. Our civil society is being reformed in the image of the giving preferences of the wealthy, in part because of the public policies we have. A tax credit would indeed change this, to get rid of the deduction altogether and to allow non-itemizers the same access to the credit. The dead hand of the donor. You're right that the Rockefeller Foundation, especially the Ford Foundation, has changed over the course of time and in such a way as to render it not merely unfamiliar to the original donor, but sometimes reprehensible. Henry Ford II, who helped to create the Ford Foundation, is on record as saying he hates what the Ford Foundation became. And in fact, the current president, for those of you in the philanthropic world, you might have seen Darren Walker. He's an extraordinary leader of the Ford Foundation, really doing some interesting things. And he says quite happily out loud that if Henry Ford knew that a gay black man is now running the assets that he put in the foundation, he would die a second death. So it can happen, but that's completely contingent upon whether the initial donor has allowed there to be a governance structure that has other people in it. And the standard arrangement, in fact, is to allow your family members and family members alone to be the trustees. The Hewlett Foundation, for example, has a law that allows other people to serve, an internal law that allows other people to serve on the foundation's board of governance, but there will always be protected seats in perpetuity for Hewlett heirs.
I'm just wondering how you would respond to the libertarian position here, which is that as a donor, you can decide whether to pay 40% of your income to taxes, to take a 40% business loss, or to give 40% to charity. Why should you prefer to pay taxes to deciding yourself who the worthy recipients are?
Right. So let me just make sure I have it right. The idea is that the libertarian is going to try everything she can to get a tax break. If it's not the charitable deduction, they'll look for a business loss, they'll look for something else. That's not the idea.
They're indifferent. They know they can go to one of three places, and they will usually prefer. Nobody wants the business loss.
Yeah.
That hurts society. But they will usually prefer the private giving.
Right. Well, in my experience talking to libertarians and my understanding of libertarian philosophy, it's an expression of a desire for a very limited government. And why it is that a libertarian would prefer there to be a tax incentive for charitable giving in the first place seems to me mysterious. If a libertarian's most cherished value is individual liberty, then let philanthropy be the simple exercise of the liberty to give away your money rather than the tax-subsidized stimulus to exercise the liberty you already possess to give your money away.
Well, the tax payment is involuntary.
That's right.
So you can't control that, and you may not have enough to subsidize your favorite charities once you've paid your taxes.
Do you think that the motivation for most people to give is to reduce their taxes? Would a libertarian stop giving if they didn't get a tax incentive?
No. If there was no government, the libertarian would give a great deal to charity.
If there was no government.
Yes.
And what if we just simply got rid of the tax incentives now altogether? There's still a government. Does the libertarian stop giving money away?
No.
Well, that's it.
The libertarian would pay for an army, probably.
For some limited things. That's right.
Yeah.
Right, to protect their stuff.
Infrastructure, defense. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Okay. I'll layer one additional thing into this, which is that, you know, I didn't talk about this in the presentation, but another seems to me relevant philosophical question is that many people believe charity or philanthropy to be a personal virtue, a form of, you know, being a good person, a character trait. And for some people, the idea that you're having a self-interested element of trying to optimize or reduce your taxes is an unfortunate corrupting influence on the exercise of what's supposed to be a pure virtue. And in fact, there are people typically in religious traditions who feel like the impulse to give is in fact an internalized obligation. And some refuse to take advantage of tax breaks because they don't want there to be a perception that their reason for giving has to do with something that has nothing to do with the practice of the virtue itself.
I'm a fundraiser in the audience. So I was reading just the very first chapter of your book, so I haven't gotten any further. But you did cite the $50 billion tax expenditure,
right,
lost revenue by charitable giving.
Correct.
But you failed to cite the $373 billion in giving that led to the $50 billion in tax.
Yeah. No, I think that's in the –
Well, in any case, you're right. Nonetheless, so one could argue that even in spite of the inefficiency you attribute to government or foundation giving, there's still a really good return on the investment from a tax expenditure point of view. If the government's losing $50 billion and getting $373 billion of – some public good, whether you agree with the public good or not.
Well, but that's a relevant question, is whether it is genuinely a public good. So here's an example. There's a guy who writes for Vox Media, the website. His name's Dylan Matthews. And every time someone makes a multi-$100 million gift to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, he writes an article that says, for the love of God, people stop giving money to Harvard. And a recent $100 million gift, I think this one was to Yale, was to renovate the dining hall by Steven Schwartzman, a financier in New York. And he wrote the article that said that, this is such a trivial thing. Yale's already got $25 billion or whatever it is in the endowment, another $100 million to renovate the dining hall, which I'm sure is already pretty pleasant. And then he wrote that the world would be better off if instead of giving that money to Yale, Steven Schwartzman had taken the $100 million and set it on fire in his backyard. And you think to yourself, well, how could that possibly be true? And of course, the answer is that Schwartzman would have paid 40% on the $100 million fire because that was an act of private consumption, and the Treasury would have $40 million. And the guess is that the benefit to society, to the average citizen, from a fraction of the total, the $100 million, makes the world a better place than renovating an already nice building at Yale.
I'm not arguing for tax benefits, but that's actually not usually the motivation by the donor. I mean, it still costs you, on a net basis, more money to give charitably and take a deduction than it would if you just paid the taxes.
That's right.
On a net basis.
Sure.
So it's still costing you more to give money away than it would be if you just paid the tax.
That's right. It's not a one-to-one substitution that you diminish your tax bill by the amount of money that you give away. So, but the relevant question here is not, it seems to me, the one I think you're posing, but the relevant question is, if we want to compare apples to oranges, and so we go back to this, if we got rid of the tax incentive altogether, an interesting empirical question is, well, what would that do to the actual phenomenon of charitable giving? How many people would stop giving money away or would give less money away if there was no incentive to do so through taxation? The studies that have been done on that show that for religion, which is a non-trivial chunk of charitable giving, it would be unchanged because people are not tax optimizing when they show up on Sunday to make a contribution to the church. What would be harmed is the amount of money given to places like wealthy universities and museums and other places. Would it go away entirely? Probably not.
Well, you're actually sort of picking on religion, though, because religion does a lot more than just pay for the cost of running a church, synagogue, or temple. I mean, religion causes like Catholic Charities or Jewish Vocational Services or other,
as I said,
places provide a lot of good to the community.
Sure.
That is not related to the
membership in the church.
Yeah.
Those have been separated out, as I said, into the relevant social service categories. The faith-based social services are counted in the relevant social service category, not in religion.
A little bit mystified as to why you did not also address, and maybe you do in your book, the interference with the democratic process that is privileged by the charitable institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Because, in theory at least, present administration accepted, if there is a society need and it gets big enough, the electorate will elect people who will deal with that.
Right.
But if you continue to permit charitable institutions to meet that need, it will permit the continued lowering of taxes, which are spent, in theory at least, under the First Amendment, the first sentence of the Constitution,
right,
for the benefit of the governed.
Yeah.
You didn't mention that. And that to me, is one of the strongest arguments for saying that you should not permit the government, which is us,
yeah,
to avoid the obligation,
yeah,
to make sure they are benefiting equally,
right,
all of the citizens.
Yeah, good. That gives me an opportunity to say something a bit about the background sort of theory of democracy that's at work in what it is I presented. So I'm saying one thing that I think is sympathetic to what you expressed and one thing that resists a little bit. I'll start with the resistance. So You're right to point out that the way we make decisions in a democratic society about the spending of tax dollars is by us, electing representatives who then have to assemble a majority in whatever legislative body to then allocate funds for some public purpose on an assumption that it benefits citizens equally. The key there is that you have to assemble a majority. And if there's a persistent minority that has a taste for or a preference for a certain public benefit or a social benefit, but can't ever assemble that majority, well, it won't be publicly provided. That's by design in democracy. So one thing that could be said on behalf of charity is that it's good partly to decentralize the production of some public goods that might not ever reach the majority level of approval through formal democratic mechanisms, so that we have some experimentation and pluralism and diversity of civil society that doesn't map on to the same things of the public goods. Now, that's the bit of resistance. The thing I want to agree with you about is that if it should turn out that we have arrangements for the provision of social services, especially those that feel like entitlements to people, food stamps, housing shelters, et cetera, and we find ourselves in a dynamic in which the government is trying to offload the responsibility of those social services to private charity, well, we're going in the opposite direction that I was describing before. Philanthropy is meant to crowd government into successful experiments that it has initially pioneered, not take over existing responsibilities of the government. I gave the Carnegie Library example before. So a few years ago when California had a big budget crisis, California state, the state government asked some philanthropists to fund some local public libraries. And the savvier of them, in my view, said, if we start doing that, there's no likelihood that the next legislative session, the public funding is restored. And it'll just become a private responsibility, what was initially a public responsibility. And I think that's the dynamic you have in mind.
But there's one other point. Who gets the most benefit out of that offloading? It is, of course, the privileged.
Yeah, in part because a surprisingly large amount of charitable giving goes to assist the social class from which it was given. Yes. Wealthy people tend to give to wealthy people causes. Poor people tend to give to poor people causes.
Well, I was thinking of something else, and that is that if you look at the basis for, in many people's mind, for lowering the tax. Mr. Reagan sold a bill of goods, and we've not, never gotten over it, that you reduce, the way you deal with government is you starve it to death.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you were really honest, you'd say the way you deal with government is that you kill all the people.
Mm-hmm.
Because you starve them to death and they can't vote. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Let's get a couple other questions.
Well, I don't really know how to phrase this. So I really appreciate a lot of the points you made because I thought they were very interesting. And I work for a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I really like about working for a nonprofit versus working for a company that has shareholders is it gives a lot more freedom
right.
in being able to actually do what the needs of the community are versus what the needs of the shareholders are. And that really plays out. And we are completely dependent on grants. Most of the grants that the nonprofit I work for come from are religious organizations, even though we ourselves are not a religious organization, just because we work with the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a weird way, it's hard to hear some of the things you're saying because it does feel like maybe it's also, in a way, discouraging philanthropy from occurring by some of the statements that you made.
Right.
And at the same time, I do feel like philanthropy and nonprofits, in particular working with the homeless, we're really filling in a gap that's
Absolutely.
Not being addressed by the government.
Yes, completely agree. Not currently being addressed by the
yeah,
government.
Yeah, and without that funding,
yeah.
nobody would be doing these things.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's a really, really important observation about a dynamic that I think will feel familiar to many people in the room, certainly feels familiar to me, both as a scholar and as an individual. So the wonky scholarly language, just to try this out for a second on you, would be I was presenting something that was assuming a first best world or a kind of ideal set of arrangements. But what should we do and what should the policies be if we live in a second best or third best world? We might think that we would want social services provided by the government in a stable way to serve the homeless, rather than having to depend upon private charity and nonprofit organizations constantly on the hustle to do them. But if the government isn't doing its job, surely it's a good thing to have something there to address people's needs. And you'd be completely on, you know, familiar territory, I'm sure everyone in the room would agree with. So from my point of view, I just want to point out the tension that we all have to face in confronting exactly what you pointed out, which is, go back to the school giving example. So as I said, and for those of you who have done this, the reason that almost everyone says that they need to give charitable dollars to their own kids' public school is because the Sacramento public school finance system is broken. They think that it should be more money on a per pupil basis for the public schools. And they think to themselves, well, as an individual citizen or even as a few people, it seems hard to imagine how to get Sacramento to change that. But what we can do as a small community is make some charitable contributions. And that'll be good for the students in our district. But what I want to point out is, since every single individual has a limited amount of time and a limited amount of money, the more that every single person makes the calculation to do the second best thing, and only the second best thing, the later the day will be that we ever try the harder structural thing to do. You know, to put it differently, take the school thing again. What is the story that anyone can tell about how the Ross School Foundation is somehow making more likely state finance reform? I don't think there is such a story. And in fact, it might even make it less likely because the savvy, politically informed people in Marin are investing their time and talent in private fundraising for the school rather than the political act of trying to change the school system. It might well be a good thing to do. I'm not so sure about the tax subsidies, to be honest about it, for that. But the dilemma that I think we all just have to confront is that doing the second best thing doesn't have a story necessarily to tell about how we try to get to the first best thing and might delay the day it comes about.
Well, what does your opinion say, like, on Prop C, which is trying to force companies to be philanthropic who are super wealthy, and instead of just being philanthropic, they're suing to not be philanthropic? I mean, and as someone who has to do the fundraising for my organization, I mean, I've been pretty disappointed to see what they offer, because most of them claim to be very philanthropic, and yet when it comes down to it, really, it's crickets.
Yes. You're going to know more about the details than I do because I don't live in San Francisco, but I've read plenty about it, so I know some. I think it's a welcome dynamic that it turns out that what we had was a contest over a proposition, which is to say the expenditure of public funds and the creation of public policy. What distressed me about what I observed from down the peninsula was that insofar as the media portrayed the debate, it was a contest between plutocrats rather than a contest between citizens and policy people having ideas. It was Jack Dorsey versus Mark Benioff, not an ordinary policy debate about what would actually be the right way forward. The substitution of a plutocratic voice in governance for the appropriate democratic voice.
Hi, thanks for that very interesting and informative talk. I'll preface this by saying I've spent a lot of time working in the nonprofit sector raising money and also in the for-profit sector with companies that want to have a mission and do good.
Yep.
And now I work for a for-profit certified B Corp in the education space. So right. There's a hybrid model that has some but not all of the tax advantages. A couple things I would say. I think you may be asking the wrong question, and not that why are we as a people and as a government subsidizing philanthropy, but why are we subsidizing the manufacture of fossil fuels? Why are we subsidizing home ownership? There are a lot of other things that have many more zeros attached to them that we as a society are paying for. Mm-hmm. So if we're incenting philanthropy, hey, maybe that's not as bad as some of the other incentives we're putting out there through our tax code. And the second thing is, having raised a lot of money and having studied this, the tax deduction actually ranks fairly low in terms of the motivation for why people give.
Right.
And the fact that the $400 billion a year annually given by all of those institutions and individuals you name has been fairly constant as a percentage of GDP for decades,
yep.
despite changes in the tax code,
right.
tells me that that is not a motivator.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about some of the major gifts,
right.
When you talk to those donors, as I've done, that doesn't rank very high. So
yep.
both anecdotally and yeah. statistically, maybe that's not the right thing. And then,
just to be sure, yeah. the inference you draw from that, which is that I've seen the same data, the same idea that roughly 2% of GDP, independent of the economy mm-hmm. or the way the incentive changes, the inference you draw from that is, well, we don't need the tax incentive then because it's not the primary motivation for people. I just want to see if that's the conclusion.
Well, I mean, I think you're fixing the wrong problem. And that if we want people to be more charitable, certainly a lever is the tax code, but
yeah.
it's not the most important lever
yeah.
or the only lever.
Yeah.
And in fact, that lever is being used to incent a whole bunch of other
right.
behavior.
Right, good. And that's the first question.
On a much greater scale.
Right. So I want to vigorously agree with you in the sense that if the book I had wanted to write was about the various ways the tax code is incenting activities that don't seem consistent with what democracy ought to be doing or should be doing or should do collectively, the charitable and philanthropic provisions would not be at the top of the list. If you were to ask me the question, what are the things that come to mind that are responsible for the ways that democracy is so dysfunctional at the moment, again, philanthropy and charity would not be at the top of the list. All I have to say in defense of this is that I wanted to write a book about the policies we have for charity and philanthropy, because there are going to be some of them no matter what. And I tried to fix my attention on what those ought to be, different than the ones that are today. Because at the end of the day, even if it's not the most important thing in a democratic society, it has a certain importance and value, especially in the sense of civil society. We're a nation of joiners. This is supposed to be something distinctive about Americans. So we ought to be thinking about the policies that we have, the social norms we have, rather than, as I suggested at the start, giving it a free pass because it just automatically seems to be a good thing.
Sure, sure. And I just one parenthetical comment on that. The preferred giving vehicle for the Chan Zuckerbergs is not
yeah,
a charitable foundation.
Exactly.
It's an LLC,
right.
which does not have those tax advantages.
You're right.
Pumping money in that, and I think that's going to be the giving vehicle of choice as we go forward for some of these wealthy individuals.
Good. The book ends with a short catalog of some of the new developments within the philanthropic sector. One of them is the rise of the choice of especially wealthy people, especially here in the Bay Area, not to do a private foundation and instead to create an LLC, a limited liability company, which can make tax-deductible gifts in the ordinary way to 501c3 public charities, can make seed investments in for-profit companies, can make contributions to 501c4 social or political advocacy groups, and can do forthright electioneering under the same roof with the same strategy, and with even lower transparency than attaches to a foundation. That's the other thing that's in the end of the book is donor advised funds. In my view, the kudzu of American charity, choking off the ordinary giving by warehousing philanthropic funds in an investment account that either Silicon Valley Community Foundation or Vanguard and Fidelity is making investment fees off of.
I'm wondering, a lot of this was focused on U.S. Is there any sort of lessons to be learned from other
yeah.
countries in
yes.
terms of them having different tax law or how
Super.
They deal with the
yeah.
wealthy
yes.
and foundations?
Yeah, I mean, since I spend my time in a political science department and I have a little bit of training in thinking about comparative politics, comparative policy, there are aspects of the book which take up this question to examine how it works elsewhere. And one of the first lessons that I want to draw from that is, although the impulse to give, the charitable activity is a kind of time immemorial activity of human beings. It exists in every society and across time, but it takes shape and structure in very different ways because of the different social norms and policies. That's why I want to focus my attention on the policies. So in other countries, tax deductions are used very infrequently. The UK has what's called a matching gift fund, so that if you give $100 to a soup kitchen, the Treasury will match to a certain extent your $100, but not diminish your tax burden. So it diminishes the collective revenues that we all have as citizens, but doesn't give you any personal tax benefit. So that's one mechanism. There are other ways of doing it that involve, first, give away 2% of your income on your own dime because of this 2% kind of threshold that seems to be the case. And only after you've given away 2% do you get a tax incentive to continue giving. That's another way that people do things. The most common thing that makes the United States the outlier is what I said at the start. Most other countries do not create a nonprofit sector, 501c3s, with as many organizations in them as the United States does. Religious organizations, puppet theaters, higher education. I mean, like, everything under the sun can count as a nonprofit in the U.S. That is not true in most other countries.
Thank you very much.
Oh, was that the last question?
Good. That was the last question.
Thank you all very much.
So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion. Thanks for coming.